to call to order our Appropriations Committee meeting of December 5th, and would you please call the roll?
Chair McKeel?
Here.
Vice Chair Crisafulli? Representatives Albritton? Batsley? Coley? Corcoran? Cruz? Frezen? Forward? Gibbons?
Here.
Gonzalez? Hooper? Hudson? Ingram? Jones excused. McBurney?
Here.
O'Toole? Hafford?
Here.
Patronus?
Here.
Precourt?
Here.
Rogers? Roussan excused. Stafford?
Here.
Stube?
Here.
Thurston?
Here.
Williams? We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And yeah, let the record reflect. Hopefully, Coley. Dear members, welcome to our first meeting of the Appropriations Committee. I am certainly pleased to be your chair, and I look forward very much to working with each and every one of you over the coming months and throughout our session to develop the state's budget. We have an important responsibility. Representative Crisafulli had a commitment, and he's going to be a few minutes late, but I'll introduce him when he gets here. My goal here is to introduce a few members and let you have some time to be introduced to our staff, which I think is going to be very important to you going forward. But I'd like to take a second to introduce Representative Joe Gibbons. Wave, Joe. Representative Gibbons is our ranking Democratic member and a good friend of mine. He also brings great budget expertise to the community. He served as the ranking member of the Government Ops Appropriations Subcommittee and on the Legislative Budget Commission. So very much look forward to working with you, sir, and thank you for your service. Members, I don't intend to keep you very long today. The purpose of our meeting is to simply familiarize, or in some cases, re-familiarize you with the jurisdiction of the committee, which I think is important, and our processes going forward over the coming months. I also want to introduce you, as I said, to our staff, who are the best in the state and who do a fantastic job and who will be invaluable to us as we accomplish our work going forward in the coming months. As you know, the primary responsibility of our committee is the production of the House PCB on the budget and its implementing and necessary conforming bills. I emphasize the word necessary. As you know, the Speaker is committed to improving the rigor of our budgeting process by ensuring that conforming bills are for the purpose of making changes to substantive law necessary to carry out our budget. I am also committed to this limitation, and I'm going to make every effort to ensure that our conforming bills do not become vehicles to circumvent the normal legislative process. As you'll see today in a short presentation, our budget situation at this moment seems somewhat improved from the extraordinarily difficult situations that you and I have all faced in the prior years. But that is not to say that we do not have extraordinary work cut out for us. You'll see shortly that we are basically at about a break-even point if the legislature were to adopt essentially a continuation budget. However, there are many risks and pressures that could alter our fiscal reality as we move forward. And my goal today is that you have some knowledge of what those risks and pressures are. We'll need to be nimble and creative in our work in crafting the General Appropriations Act this year. Before we get to our presentation, I'd like to introduce our staff and their respective assigned areas of responsibility. To my right is Joanne Lesnoff. Joanne is our staff director, and to my left is Cheryl Randolph. Cheryl, raise your hand. Our administrative assistant. The rest of our staff is sitting behind us, and if each of you could stand as I introduce you so members can see who you are. The committee has two deputy staff directors. Trina Kramer is the deputy director, who also serves as a legal counsel for the committee. Sarah Voiles is the deputy in charge of the budget coordination. Denise Popvin is the budget chief for information technology. Assigned to her is Michelle Mullins, who also works on IT. Gus Delaney is the analyst assigned to state employee pay and benefits. And we have Fred Burns, who may not be here, but who works closely behind the scenes with our complex automated budgeting system. I would also like to introduce the budget chiefs of the subcommittees. As the subcommittee budget products move to this committee, these staff get double duty, and they work for our committee as well. In education, Alice Heflin. For health care, Eric Pridgen. For for Justice Loretta Darity. Greg Davis is the Chief for TED Appropriations. Stephanie Massengale for Agriculture and Natural Resources, and Bruce Topp, Government Operations. Don Langston is the Staff Director for Finance and Tax. He's not here because that subcommittee is meeting right now. But I think that, as I said a minute ago, you're going to find that our staff is top-notch. They are, again, in my opinion, the best of the state. I wanted to make a take extraordinary time and make sure that you are able to familiarize yourself with them, because please feel free to utilize their resources. They're extraordinary. And before I recognize Joanne for an introductory presentation, I'd like to call your attention to some resource information in front of you that's been prepared in addition to today's presentation. It includes summary budget information for this committee and each of its subcommittees. Its purpose is to familiarize you with the entire budget, provide some recent history, and some of the issues we may be dealing with going forward. Members, I encourage you to read all of this. My script says to read it at your leisure. I think that you would be well advised to read it relatively quickly, because the sooner you become involved and knowledgeable about our budget, particularly the budget areas that you serve on, the more helpful you will be to your area of interest, but also to the committee as a whole. And now I'd like to introduce Joanne Lesnoff to provide us a committee overview. Ms. Lesnoff, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. Today I have a very brief presentation for you, which includes a high-level overview of the committee and its jurisdiction. Additionally, there's a review and update of the long-range financial outlook, as well as a quick refresher on the budget process and its associated timeline. The first slide here outlines the structure of House Appropriations. The committee has seven subcommittees organized into sub-jurisdictional food groups, so to speak. As you all know, appropriations from the state treasury must be assigned to a state agency. Even if the ultimate recipient of the appropriation is not a state agency, the original appropriation must be made to a state agency, which is then subsequently transferred to its intended recipient, like perhaps a local government or a nonprofit organization. So each state agency or entity which receives appropriations is assigned to one of the seven subcommittees. As all of you are returning members, you can see that there is little change from last year's structure. There are two changes, most predominantly the Education Committee has been combined to include all of pre-K through 12, as well as higher education. And the other notable change is that the Finance and Tax Committee is now a subcommittee of appropriations, whereas last year it was a standalone committee. You can see that there are no agencies assigned to Finance and Tax, since it will concern itself with revenue and finance issues. Also, you can see that the Appropriations Committee has some entities that are directly assigned to it. Those are the budgets of the legislature and governor, education, fixed capital outlay, state employee pay and benefits, and statewide information technology issues. Drilling down a little bit into each of these areas of responsibility, you can see the budget entities, or in certain cases, the types of issue that the committee addresses. The governor's office is comprised of its executive management and support, which are its administrative support and executive management on the plaza level. Funding, the next bullet addresses the funding for our appropriation system. This system is housed in the governor's office, though the staff and resources are managed jointly by the House, Senate, and governor's appropriations folks. There is the Office of Planning and Budgeting, or otherwise known as OPB. They call themselves Policy and Budget. Statutorily, they are still the Office of Planning and Budgeting. Further down, you can see the Division of Emergency Management. This was transferred in October of 2011 from the former Department of Community Affairs. It was transferred to the governor's office. The legislature's budget is, of course, comprised of the House and Senate. but there are other offices and entities such as OPAGA or EDR, as well as some other support entities in the legislature. The Office of Economic and Demographic Research, or EDR, is of special importance to the work of this committee because it, as well as the staffs of the House, Senate, and Governor's Office, produced the estimate for most of our significant revenues and workloads, in addition to providing estimates for bills with fiscal impacts. The next area, called State Employee Pay and Benefits and Other Administered Funds, is a special area of the budget that is actually called Administered Funds. It sits in Section 6 of the GAA. And what that is an area where many of the appropriations are done in lump sum in that area, and then once the budget is signed, the governor's office implements and distributes those funds to most state agencies or to the state agencies that are directed to receive them. This typically involves issues regarding retirement distributions or health insurance distributions. Domestic security is in administered funds, and sometimes you'll see various funding to go to specified agencies, and the governor's office distributes those after the bill is signed. The committee also oversees information technologies that are a statewide concern, such as data center consolidation and enterprise IT governance. The detailed budget work of data center consolidation will occur in the government operations appropriations subcommittee, but some of the policy decisions regarding that effort will occur here. And lastly, the committee handles all issues relating to fixed capital outlay for education. Excuse me. This slide displays the funding of the committee's jurisdiction by fund source and by program. The pie chart to the left depicts the committee's funding by fund type. As you can see, it is predominantly state funds. Most of these funds are for fixed capital outlay for education, and almost all of it is for debt service. So of the $1.6 billion in fixed capital outlay for education in state funds that you see on line 2 in the chart above, $1.3 billion of that is for debt service, and therefore not available or discretionary to the committee. The federal funds are the funding in the Division of Emergency Management and Domestic Security funding, and the general revenue is predominantly the funding for the legislature. The chart to the right simply shows the breakout by agency or function. As the chairman noted, the primary work of the committee is the development of the House PCB on the budget. So a review and update of long-range financial outlook may be helpful in assisting the committee assess the state's fiscal situation for the development of the 13-14 budget. Section 3, Article 19C1 requires the Legislative Budget Commission to issue a long-range financial outlook, setting out recommended fiscal strategies for the state and its departments and agencies in order to assist the legislature in making budget decisions. The outlook depicts, over a multi-year period, the estimated gap or surplus in our general revenue funds between estimated revenues and estimated expenditures. The estimates are derived from either official estimates of major revenues and workload from the consensus estimating conferences or from estimates based on historical experience or other known factors developed by the budget staffs of the House and Senate. This slide represents a basic formula of this year's plan. And as you can see, it's a simple formula. We begin by taking a look at available revenues. And this is the plan that was adopted by the LBC in September of this year. At the time, our revenues were at $27.5 billion. This year, there was a joint decision by the LBC members on the House and Senate to include $1 billion in reserve, and in addition to that, there are some required paybacks to both the Lawton Childs Fund and the Budget Stabilization Fund. So the first thing off the table is the subtraction of those reserves of that $1.2 billion. The next things that is subtracted are the anticipated appropriations, which are comprised of essentially three components. One is the base budget, which at the time was estimated to be $24.6 billion. And then there is the development of what are critical needs and high priority needs. And those are, there is some art involved in that. Critical needs are those that are deemed by the LBC to be essential. Other high priority needs are those that have been typically funded but are in a lower tier than critical needs. When you do the math of subtracting the reserves and the appropriations from the expected revenues, you come out with either a surplus or a shortfall, as indicated by the purple shape at the end, which historically has been bright red for STOP, as it has shown a perpetual shortfall. But this is the second year in a row, actually, where the September LBC projects a surplus. Last year, it was over $270 million, and this year at $71 million, which is essentially flat. This slide contains a listing of the major critical budget drivers adopted in the outlook. These are those drivers, again, that are considered mandated or essential by the LBC under current law and current administration, so the LBC does not assume any change in policy. Please do not despair. I do not intend to go over each of these unless, Mr. Chairman, you want me to. But I do want to show you, however, the types of issues that are considered critical, such as funding Medicaid and maintaining the per-student funding in the FEFP. Those two issues are the largest contributors to our critical drivers. In the FEFP summer conference, there was estimated an increase of in excess of 100,000 students, equating to additional need of $183 million. In Medicaid, you'll see there's an additional need of $287 million in general revenue. Line 9, I just do want to point out that in critical needs, there is an aspect of federal health care reform that is mandated, and that is the funding of an automatic increase to physician reimbursement rates. These costs will be picked up by the federal government for 2 years and is mandatory during that time frame, after which they become discretionary at the normal matching rate. The matching rate for this year, for example, is 58% for 2013, and that changes annually. Other critical drivers include but are not limited to paying for past disaster funding, funding the state employee health insurance program, funding the state's casualty and property insurance program, and funding the per-level base funding for our constitutionally required voluntary pre-K program. So those are just some examples of critical funding drivers. This next chart represents the other high priorities needs. These are those items that are important and or typically funded but are not deemed as critical by the LBC. As you can see in perusing down this list, there are two items that stand out. One is our economic development programs. These include all the incentive programs like quick action closing and others. And these are funded annually but with non-recurring funds. There are several places in the budget where this phenomenon occurs, and we've actually called these funds recurring, non-recurring. The $114 million that you see there is a four-year average. The other large item that you see is $447 million for the unfunded actuarial liability of the Florida retirement system on line 22. For years, our retirement system was funded as a surplus, but its investments have suffered along with the market during the recent recession. The state has had a UAL for a number of years. This would ensure that, assuming the assumptions made in the valuation are correct, that the retirement fund would be 100% funded after 29 years, again, if the assumptions are correct. As you can see, there are additional 21 items of other high priorities needs, but those two alone comprise 55% of the total $1 billion of need. Since the adoption of the long-range financial outlook, another round of consensus estimating conferences is underway. These conferences are done for the development of the governor's budget. The conferences that made up the long-range financial outlook were done in the summer and were done specifically for the development of the outlook. So there have been some changes that have been adopted by these conferences. These changes are new official estimates, but they are not technically an official change to the plan, as they have not been adopted by the LBC. However, the most predominant change since the adoption of the plan has nothing to do with the change in estimating conferences. They have to do with changes in our general revenue funds available on line one. You'll see that there has been a $336 million change to our expected revenues. All of those revenues are non-recurring, and all of those are attributable to agency reversions. So this is not an indication of very recent improvements. This is simply funds that we expected the state agencies to spend, but that they ultimately reverted. And again, they are non-recurring. On line two, the base budget in the official outlook was an estimate. It was off $15 million, or 1/6 of 1%. I would say that's not too bad. In critical needs, various adjustments to the estimates so far yield a need of $15 million, as you can see on line three. And in other high priority needs, the change decreased to the need of almost $30 million, almost entirely attributable to a decline in the estimated need for community colleges. The net effect of all of this is a $365 million improvement. As the chair said, this is, in the scheme of things, relatively still flat. And as I noted previously, last year we expected to be $273 million to the good, and that did not materialize. This is how things stand right now. There continue to be conference updates, and there will be a whole another set of estimating conferences in the spring for the legislature to use in the development of the GAA. So this, right now, what you are looking at is simply a snapshot. And just in case there are any sparks of optimism among you, I would like to illustrate the difference between the official outlook and its adjustments since the inception of the outlook in 2008 and 2009. The outlook was adopted by the voters in 2006, so the first outlook was developed in the ensuing fall for the 08-09 fiscal year. What you see in each of the blue lines is the official estimated shortfall or surplus at the time the LBC adopted the long-range financial outlook. The gray line portrays the adjustments, taking the same critical drivers, the same high-priority needs. Nothing changed except for the estimates at the time the legislature had to adopt the budget. Since the outlook did not consistently account for $1 billion in reserve, this slide has been adjusted to assume that for comparative and illustrative purposes. As you can see, in each year, the state situation worsened considerably from September through the spring. Last year was the first year, as I said, where there was a surplus in the plan. We were expected to be to the good of over 270, but ended up $1 billion in the hole. Over the five-year period, the total amount of shortfall was $21 billion, and the amount of discrepancy between where we thought we would be and where you ended up was $6.5 million. In addition to the possibility of changes in the estimates, there are additional pressures and risks to the plan. As an example, we use the agency budget requests as one of those pressures. This chart shows on line 3 that same positive balance that may be available should estimates hold. The next line on line 4 shows the agency requests and that of the court system over and above what was included in the long-range financial outlook. Some of these things are things you may wish to consider funding. If you wanted to fund all agency requests over the plan as it stands right now, you'd have to come up with $1.1 billion in solutions to pay for it, as indicated on line 5. Of course, there are other pressures, but the agency requests are a large example, and those are already out. They came out on October 15th, so it's a tangible example to provide to you. There are also risks to the plan, and 3 of those risks are listed. We don't know what the resolution to the fiscal cliff may be, but it is likely, regardless of whether the current plan is enacted or whether a new agreement is reached, that the impact to the state will be several $100 million in funding to federal grants received by the state. We also know there is pending litigation that may have an adverse impact to the state, and we know that this is a generally a period of instability in the global economy. And as a wise woman once told me, what goes on in Europe does not necessarily stay in Europe. This is just, of course, I know you're all familiar with the budget process, but just to refresh your memories, state agencies submit their budgets on concurrently to the legislature and the governor on October 15th. The governor's budget is due within 30 days of the onset of session. Both chambers will evaluate, deliberate, and produce appropriations, implementing and conforming bills for their respective chambers. In the House, the subcommittees produce budget recommendations and pass conforming bills supporting those recommendations to this committee. As stated by the chairman, this committee will produce the PCB, the implementing bill, and any conforming bills related to the jurisdiction of this committee. Once the bill passes past the floor of each chambers, differences between the two bills will be resolved by conference committees appointed by the Speaker and the Senate President. Conference reports for the budget and the implementing bill must be on the desk 72 hours before a vote is taken upon them. By joint rule, conforming bills must sit for 24 hours prior to a vote. Once the bill is presented to the governor, he has 15 days to sign it, veto it, or let it become law without signature. And, of course, he has line item veto authority. There are 2 allocation periods in this process. One is before subcommittees produce their final recommendations to this committee. The authority for those allocations rests with the speaker. The other allocations are produced by the Senate President and the Speaker for conference committee allocations. The timeline for the budget process has varied over the years. This chart depicts the history of at what point in session the subcommittees have submitted their spreadsheet recommendations, when the committee produces its PCB, when the bill has passed the floor of the House, and when conference allocation were finalized, and finally when the conference report has been placed on the desk. Most typically, spreadsheets are produced in week 3 or 4, with the PCB and House floor actions occurring within the subsequent 2 weeks. Allocations most frequently are finalized in week 7, with the bill on the desk in the last week. When that process was protracted in the 2009 session, a session was extended 1 week specifically to complete the budget. So I can't tell you how the process will unfold this year, but this historical information can serve as a guideline. And, Mr. Chairman, that is all I have.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, Ms. Lesloff. Members, you've heard the presentation. As I said earlier, my goal was not to keep you a very long time, but I'm certainly happy to, and I know Joanne is happy to entertain any questions that you may have. Other questions? Representative Hudson, for question, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know there are several pending lawsuits that could impact the state budget. The one that concerns me the most, however, is the Williams case regarding the changes made to the retirement system in 2011. What would be the fiscal impact of an adverse ruling?
Ms. Lesoff, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly any impact would be dependent on just how the court would rule, and so that is somewhat of an unknown. However, there are some things that we do know. We do know that there were two major portions of the retirement changes that were challenged. One regarded changes to the cost of living adjustment that is provided to retirees on an annual basis, and the other to the 3% contribution made by employees to their own retirement. If both of those issues resulted in an adverse impact to the state, we believe that we'd be looking at, on a recurring basis, $862 million of recurring costs. There are also non-recurring costs, and those can be calculated a little differently depending on how you look at some of the issues. The non-recurring costs for certain include the 3% that have already been paid back, that would may need to be paid back to employees. You know, our estimate of that looks to be approximately $763 million. So a potential total impact could be higher than $1.6 billion. But again, we don't really know what the court may do or how they may rule, but that gives you an idea of what kind of an impact that could be.
Representative Pafford, for your question, sir. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hudson actually hit my question on the head. I guess the question I would have as a follow-up is the $1.6 billion. Depending on how the court ruled, the state may or may not have an ability to pay that out over more than an annual period. It could be multiple periods. Would that be correct to assume?
Joanne, you recognize?
Representative Pafford, I can't answer that because I don't know what the court may direct. So I don't know if that will be an option for the legislature or not.
Any more questions? Representative Williams, you recognize her question? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that same line, thank you, Chair Hudson, for your mic. Along that same line, Ms. Lesnoff, is it my understanding that those dollars that, say that $1.6 billion, those have not gone into some kind of escrow? I thought once the lawsuit had gone in, I thought those dollars were taken out, but they were also put into escrow.
Do you have any arguments?
I can check with Gus Delaney or Trina, but the dollars that are paid by the state employees are paid into the retirement fund. My recollection was that there was a request for them to be placed in escrow, but I don't know if that was approved.
Do I? Gus, you're recognizing.
Yeah, there was a request by the plaintiffs to put that into an escrow, but then it was that was reversed. The judge did not authorize it, so those monies they're in the retirement fund at this point. They were not put into an escrow.
Thanks, Gus. Representative Stafford, you recognize for a question. Is that not right? I'm so sorry. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had you wrong on my list, and I'm sorry. Representative Rogers, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question speaks to the foreclosure situation or crisis that we had, whether or not that would play into how do you factor that into your estimates, and will that be a major factor?
Are you recognized?
If you're referring to the funding stream for the state court system, that estimate, or are you referring to the settlement that the Attorney General
No. I'm speaking to our current ad valorem as it relates to, have we peaked in our foreclosure? In your estimate, are we thinking we have already peaked, or will foreclosures across the state impact the revenues at any given point? And second to that would be our credit rating as a state. Does our reserve, do we have enough budgeted for in our reserves to keep our ratings at the level that it is?
Recognized.
Oh, thank you. The consensus estimating conference regarding ad valorem revenues is indeed included in our estimates, and they certainly take a look at the foreclosures. I would probably ask Don Langston and can get some information as to the detail of the ad valorem estimate, but those are taken into consideration in the plan. I'm sorry, your next question was?
Just as it relates to your reserves and our ratings.
Yeah, right now, of course, the plan contemplates $1 billion in reserves. We know that rating agencies are concerned about state reserves and always take a look at those. We think that for the current year, after the budget stabilization fund is paid back as directed by appropriations in the current year, in the month of June, that we would have $700 million in the budget stabilization fund and $460 million in the Lawton Childs Endowment Fund. To say whether or not that satisfies the rating agencies, you know, they don't give us a specific number, but they do pay attention to reserves, and in recent years, the legislature has been very focused on maintaining appropriate reserves.
Thank you.
Okay, I understand, Representative Williams, you have a follow-up question you'd like to ask.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to catch you before you went on to the next one. Ms. Lesnoff, on the going back to the dollars that Chair Hudson was talking about with the pension lawsuit, has there been any scoring, dynamic scoring, applied to those dollars that they return to the state employees? And with that scoring, does it reduce that $862 million that you spoke of earlier?
Attorney, you recognize?
I'm not aware of any dynamic scoring as to any, I guess you're referring as to whether or not there'd be any positive economic impact to that. I'm unaware of any scoring that we've done to that effect. And the percentage of the $860 million that is attributable to the 3% is $456 million. So only that amount of the $861 is for the 3%. The rest is for the prospective COLA adjustments.
Members, are there any other questions on the presentation? Okay. Members, I thank you very much for your attention today. I failed to do one thing, and that was I'd like to introduced our ranking member, Representative Gibbons, but I would like to take a moment to introduce our Vice Chair, Representative Crisafulli. Representative Crisafulli was instrumental last year in developing our agriculture and natural resources budget, and having served as a very active Vice Chair of that Appropriations Committee, is I'm grateful for his expertise, his calm and deliberative manner, and he's going to be a great member of our committee going forward, and I'm happy to be working alongside you, sir. Welcome. Okay, with that, members, if there is nothing else to come before us, Representative Gibbons moves to rise.